Welcome to the Collector Show for another week of collecting. I'm Harold Nickel here on Web Talk Radio. In the interview segment of the program, we're going to be talking about the biggest collection of seashells that you can see at any one time anywhere in the world, and it's in a place you might not guess. Just a bit off the beaten path, but not so far that you couldn't go see it if you wanted to. And then in our segment with Larry Zale, we're going to talk about protecting our collectibles, auctions, but first, news from the world of collecting. There's an exhibition of Tibetan art in Beijing's Grand Theater. An exhibition from the Beauty of Tibet painting contest is currently being displayed at the National Grand Theater in Beijing. If you go there, you can see more than 200 pieces of art that were all based on the sights and sounds of the Tibetan plateau. Award-winning artwork all based on the theme of Tibet. So, if you're in China and you're in Beijing and you happen to be walking past the National Grand Theater, you can go in there and see a collection of Tibetan art. Now, this is a very cool story. There were only a handful of these made even when they were popular. A popcorn wagon. There was a popcorn wagon that was sold for $374,000 in a Gooding & Company auction. It was really an auction for cars, like automobiles, but this happened to be a device, a piece of equipment that was originally built in 1915. It weighed over 6,000 pounds and was 17 feet long. And what it did was roast and store and pop popcorn using steam. So, a great thing to look at. I'll have a photo of it up on the Collector Show website, collectorshow.net, for you to look at. But a very interesting piece of engineering from the early 20th century. And if I'm right, my best guess is that machines like this were built for the World's Fair and events like that. But $374,000, I thought was low, considering there's only a half a dozen of these left anywhere. There's a new collectible from the WWE, The Undertaker. It's 17 and a half inches tall. It has wonderful detail, and it's going to retail for $295 starting in December of 2013. Undertaker, you may know if you follow wrestling, is one of the more popular and successful characters in sports entertainment of all time. This one is actually lit, and you'll get a piece of the ring from The Undertaker's match with his brother Kane, which was an inferno match where the ring actually caught on fire. And if you saw that, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you're a wrestling devotee, you're probably going to want one. It's like the, it's the same company that made the Wolverine statue we talked about last week. Very, very detailed work and easily recognizable to anybody who follows wrestling. All right. Let's say you think you have an automobile and you think it might be a collectible classic, but you're not sure. Well, one way to tell is to put it up for auction and see if anybody buys it. So Auctions America, which is a unit of classic car specialists, RM Auctions, said it's going to offer a 1983 Chrysler LeBaron Town & Country convertible for auction during its fall car sale. It's a boxy style with a lot of fake wood, and I don't want one, but we'll see if anybody else buys it at auction, making it an absolutely bona fide collectible. I think a used car like this is going to go for $2,500, maybe. I don't know. Ugh. All right, now this ties in with what Larry's going to talk about, new asset protection. A new product in the insurance market is hoping to change the way insurers, agents, and policyholders track valuable contents. It's called Trove. Trove, which is meant to represent a treasure trove of valuable or personal information kept in one place. It's a structure or a closet. It's AIG, Fireman's Fund, Hiscox UK, and Pure who makes it. They announce discounts for policyholders who activate a Trove to collect and manage information about their property and possessions. The product is meant to provide transparency into the value of insured items. As a result, insurers hope to reduce risk and better protect clients' possessions through accurate insurance policy pricing. Scott Walchek, who's the founder and CEO of the San Francisco-based company, said the product was meant to expose risk in a collection during the underwriting process. Trove exposes changes to the value of insured items and connects insurers to policyholders' acquisitive lives to ensure tangible assets are always accounted for and, with accurate insurance to value, they're always protected. You've heard Larry talk in the past about some people who intentionally don't insure their items because they don't want them to know what they have and what they're worth. Okay, they don't want one of these. But if you are one of the people who does want to insure their valuables, this sounds like a pretty good deal and likely something I'm going to want to follow up with the nice people out in San Francisco. Okay, coming up next, the biggest seashell collection on display anywhere on the Collector Show. It's Web Talk Radio. Well, it's the interview segment of the Collector's Show. In the past on the program, we've talked about collecting sand, beach sand. We've talked about collecting meteorites. We've talked about collecting all kinds of things. But until now, we have never spoken with anyone who collected seashells. But I'm very pleased to tell you that we're going to talk to somebody who does just that and has taken it to another level. We're going to welcome Patty Humbert, who's the Educational Director for the Brazosport Museum of Natural Science, to the program. And Patty, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, let's start at the beginning. How did the museum decide that they were going to begin displaying a large collection of seashells?
Well, the museum began with Mildred Tate, and she had, and her husband moved to the area when Dow first started down here, and she became interested in collecting seashells. She also did a lot of going down and buying shells from the shrimpers who were coming in. Back then, the shrimp boat people would keep the shells on their boats, and so she would go down and see what they brought in and buy the shells and started her collection that and walking on the beach. But after a while, she became really interested in teaching children, educating them about shells and about the natural world. And so she basically came up with the idea for the Brazosport Museum.
Okay, so, and for people who aren't familiar with the area, the Dow Chemical Company was and remains a major employer in the area and began their manufacturing operations here in Southeast Texas during the Second World War. And some of the original inhabitants, I guess, or people who came here at that time were some of the ones who really made some lasting contributions to the community. Is that a fair thing to say, Patty?
It is. They basically founded Lake Jackson and started it on the road to what it is today.
Okay, so there's an individual who collects these seashells and decides to use this as an opportunity to teach children, but I guess teach children what?
Well, she wanted them to learn about shells and about the natural world. She started out actually have a classroom that they ran as a small museum for the school district. I think it was at Velasco, the old Velasco Elementary. Mm-hmm. And, as the school district grew, then there was a need for the classroom. And at that point, they moved into downtown Lake Jackson.
Okay, so tell us then about how she and how you now today go about collecting seashells. What are you looking for in a shell that you're going to add to the collection at the museum?
Well, as you can imagine, since the museum has been around since the early 60s, we have a huge shell collection. So basically for the museum now to add shells, we're looking for something very unusual, something that we don't already have. We have a huge collection of shells that have come out of the Gulf of Mexico, off the Texas beaches, but also we have shells, from around the world. So at this point, what we'd really be looking for would be something very unusual.
Okay, so can you give us an example of what unusual, what that might entail?
Well, now, a lot of the shell collectors mostly come out of the Indo-Pacific, mainly the Philippines.
Uh-huh.
But there are some people, particularly off New Caledonia, that are actually dredging. So they're being able to pick shells up off the bottom in very deep water. And so some of these are brand new species that have never been seen before and are just now being named. So something like that would be a really good addition to the collection.
So if someone were to dredge up a prehistoric shell or a shell from a species that no longer existed, that would be something you guys would want to put on display?
That would be, actually, the way our museum is set up, we have what is like the modern shells, and then the fossils actually fall under a different curator completely.
Okay.
Which I'm sure he would love to have any kind of old fossils like that, because actually, considering how great our shell collection is, our shell fossil collection isn't that extensive.
Okay.
But mainly what we're looking for now would be these new species that they're not, you know, it's just that nobody has collected from those depths before. And so that's why they're finding these new species. They've been around. They just, nobody had collected them.
If I come to the museum and I want to learn more about shells and see your collection, what would I experience?
Well, that is one of the things that makes our museum so special. I've been to other museums that have probably some of the best collection of seashells in the world, but you can't see them. They're all back in the back in boxes and cabinets. One thing you will see in our museum is you will see seashells. Practically every shell we have is on exhibit where the public can come and look at it. So if you've found a shell at the beach and you want to know what it is, you can bring it in. You can start looking through our collection that's in plain public view and probably figure out what your shell is.
And if you know, how big is the collection? Do you know how many pieces there are?
At one time, they were talking in the neighborhood of 15,000 to 16,000.
Wow.
But again, you've got some duplicate shells. There's not that we have that many unique shells.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have a very large shell collection. And as I say, the main thing that makes ours unique is that it is on public view.
And one of the things that we've learned here on the Collector's Show is that often there's a community or a group of people who, whether formal or informal, will meet regularly to compare notes and learn from each other about the different things they're collecting. And there doesn't seem to be any collectible item that we've talked about here on the program that didn't have some kind of a group or association. Do you guys have a group of people who get together and talk about collecting seashells?
We do. We have a local seashell collecting club. It's called the Seashell Searchers of Brazoria County.
Okay, I want you to say Seashell Searchers ten times fast.
That's really hard to say.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
And when we were doing our Seashell Searcher Shell Show,
it got really difficult.
But we meet the first Tuesday of the month in the museum.
Okay.
At 7:30, and we welcome anyone that has any interest in shells. We usually have programs, and a lot of times those involve just looking at pretty pictures of shells. But people talk about the things they're finding on the beach, which is kind of rare now to find anything on our beaches. But we also go on field trips.
Mm-hmm.
Where we go out and look for shells. And, you know, we would really welcome people to come and visit with us. We also, all of the shellers in Texas try to meet together every other year.
There's a group called Shellers?
Well, that's kind of the loose, what we call ourselves.
Okay.
They call it a Sheller's Jamboree.
Oh.
People that pick up seashells are called Shellers.
Okay.
And there's also a couple of national organizations. We belong to one that's called the Conchologist of America.
I'm sorry, that word was what collegist?
Conchologist.
Conchologist.
Like the conch shell.
Okay, so in addition to being a fun hobby to collect, there's a whole new vocabulary associated with shell collecting, and a lot of it is really kind of hard to say.
It is, and because if you're really into it, you're into the scientific names and things, and then you get into this whole, you know, it's Latin, it's a dead language, none of us took it in high school, so everybody says every word differently. It can make it real interesting when two people are talking about the same shell and don't know it.
I'll bet that's right. Now, for the people who don't live in Southeast Texas or who don't have plans to visit, tell us about what we might be able to see of the collection online? Do you have things that people can eyeball via the internet?
We've not done that yet. There are a lot of museums that are, I know Houston Museum is trying to get their collection online. At this point, we're such a small volunteer organization, it would take, you know, someone with just the drive to want to start identifying our shells and taking pictures and putting them on the internet. I don't see that being anything that our museum will do in the next couple of years.
So to experience what I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, Patty, one of the biggest seashell collections in the world, you have to come to the museum.
Well, the biggest collection on display.
Okay, the biggest collection on display.
Right, that we put that disclaimer because, you know, Houston Museum's going to say, but our collection is bigger. And, you know, they're right. But you want to see their collection? No, it's not happening.
Yeah, I don't think it counts if you can't actually look at it. So, but in the interest of fairness, we'll maintain the biggest collection on display.
Yes.
Now tell people listening how they can get in touch with you.
Well, we have a website.
Okay. Can you give us the address?
It's the Brazosport Museum of Natural Science.
Okay.
And it's BMNS, which are basically our initials, .org.
Okay, Brazosport Museum of Science .org. And should anybody want to contact you, Patty, do you want to give out your email?
On the museum's website, there is actually, the museum has a website, and it's BMNS, which again, Brazosport Museum Natural Science, at BCFAS, which is Brazosport Center for Arts Sciences.
Okay.
Because we are part of that group that is out at the center. And they might also find other information for some of the other member groups that they would find interesting.
Okay. Well, you've opened our eyes to a whole different type of collecting. The biggest seashell collection on display anywhere on planet Earth. And I want to thank Patty Humbert, who's the educational director for the Brazosport Museum of Natural Science, for being on the Collector Show. Thank you, Patty.
Well, thank you, and I hope everybody will come and see us.
I hope so, too. Stay tuned for more here on Web Talk Radio. I'm Harold Nickel. Well, it's one of the more popular segments on our program, if not the most popular, Lawrence C. Zale, who is an expert in the field of all things collectible. Although he and I sometimes quibble about the word expert, he knows a great deal about the world of collectibles. And Larry, welcome back to the program.
Harold, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, so we've been going through what I consider to be several workshops or instructional sessions led by you that are really helping to educate all of us about collecting and ways to enhance the appeal of our collections. Where are you going to take us this week?
Well, last week we talked about documenting objects. This week I'd like to discuss caring for and protecting a collection.
Okay. So in terms of care, are we talking about protecting physical items?
Very much so. Once a collector purchases something, they're going to need to take care of that object, which invariably becomes part of a collection. We discussed the documentation last week, as I've just said, but we'll need, for example, to consider a couple of things, and I'll go over them slowly so listeners can think about them and see if they apply to them.
Okay.
The first, it seems to me, is that keep your home or wherever you reside at a constant temperature. Ideally, I would say between 65 and 75 degrees Fahrenheit and between 47 and 55% relative humidity. The reason for that is that the relative humidity, if you have too much, for example, moisture, you may find your objects covered with mold.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, Harold, if you have very dry air, it may cause paper to become fragile or wood to crack.
Yeah, those are both good points, and I've lived in both very dry and very humid climates, and both can really damage prints, color prints, paper, and even cardboard boxes with four-color printing on them. And in some cases, for the things that we collect, we've put them not just in climate-controlled atmospheres, but taken it a step further with sealed boxes and sealed up plastic cases.
Right. And I think collectors need to do a personal evaluation of what they collect and make that determination. A couple of others, if I may.
Sure, please.
I think that collections should be kept out of direct sunlight.
Okay.
Ultraviolet light will cause severe and sometimes even irreversible damage to the art. When I say art, it could also be an object as well.
Sure.
And those that are particularly vulnerable are paper, textiles, and photographs.
That's a good point, because the chemistry involved with direct sun, heat, and light causes a lot of adverse reactions in the pigments. I also, just as an aside, went to buy a Christmas ornament once, and I could tell that the person who had owned it had left it in a window because one side was yellow, like you couldn't even recognize it. It was very, very yellow, and the other side looked like new.
And, precisely, yes.
Yeah, needless to say, I didn't buy it.
Sure. A couple of others, if I may. I think collectors should consider installing water alert sensors. Now, that may sound a bit over the top, but, you know, if your home is susceptible to water damage, you know, you may want to, you know, consider sealing trays and underneath washers, dryers, and radiators, and that sort of thing. Most folks will not be adversely affected, but it's something to consider, especially with the climatic changes we're experiencing throughout the country, or for that matter, throughout the world.
Well, that's a good point. And if you've ever had a flooded basement, and we have, and if you've ever had a leaky roof, and we have, you know that Mother Nature plays no favorites when it comes to damaging your carpeting, your furniture, or your collectibles. And this is where I'll come out in favor of non-cardboard boxes for the storage of darn near anything, but particularly items that are part of your collection. The cardboard, if it gets wet, it's done. Whereas if you have plastic or glass or even a metal box to keep things in, you've got a much better chance of your collectibles staying in decent shape. And other than my unfortunate experience with the sun bleached Christmas ornament, Larry, I'm guessing that you have some examples of folks who wished that they had taken steps to protect their collectibles.
Yes, for example, a client in Miami did not properly prepare for the hurricane season and suffered tremendous water and wind damage because they did not take these issues into consideration. And the areas of the country, the Northeast, that were, for example, affected by Hurricane Sandy, are now all confronted with the additional charge of flood insurance, which I covered some weeks ago, but even though they may be on high ground and were not directly affected by Sandy, the insurance companies are now demanding flood insurance. Well, there are ways in which collectors can help offset that potential by, you know, following some of the steps that we've discussed. It would also seemed to me that with precious objects, collectors should install smoke detectors,
right,
not heat detectors.
Now help us discern the difference, because I know that most homes these days do come with smoke detectors, but you're making a distinction that oh, my computer's talking at me. I'm going to have to Zuri is talking to me. I'm going to have to edit this out, Larry. I'm so sorry. This is not my day when it comes to gadgets. Shut up, Zuri. Okay, so, Mr. Editor, we're going to be talking about smoke and heat detectors. 3, 2, 1. So, Larry, you're making a distinction between smoke detectors and heat detectors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that most homes, the fire department always recommends that you have a smoke detector, and that's a particulate detection unit, but what I'm hearing you, I think, is a distinction around temperature. Is that correct?
Well, I think a heat detector will provide little protection against such things as smoke damage or soot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that these smoke detectors, if they're installed, say, 100 to 150 feet, from the objects you wish to protect, that should be sufficient.
And maybe this is crazy, but are we talking about heat from a furnace, perhaps, or heat from a fireplace, or heat from an oven? Is that
right?
Okay, those are all. Those are good. And again, back to just good old eighth grade chemistry. Heat will play havoc and cause different kinds of chemical reactions and things like pigments and even printed materials, four-color or two-color, and especially old newsprint or any kinds of color print that has reproduced fine art. But my guess is that with original works of fine art, it's even more pronounced. Is that a fair conclusion?
Very much so, and unfortunately for many collectors who don't take these steps, they suffer the consequence. And once the damage is done, there are instances where restoration will help, but that can be very costly. In some instances, it may be too advanced to be restored. Or another way of looking at it, if they want to sell these works at a later date, they will be drastically reduced in value.
So when you're having an object appraised that's had restoration work done because of smoke or water, you have to declare that as part of the appraisal. Is that right?
Well, what will typically happen is if you want to sell it through a dealer or an auction house, their experts will quickly determine the damage.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was worth, $5,000 before, it can be reduced by 40-50% or more.
Ouch.
With this type of damage. So that's not a happy ending, I'm afraid.
No, it's not. And going back to the example you cited of Hurricane Sandy, we had just moved from the East Coast and grew up along the Gulf Coast, and the last thing I had in mind when I moved to the northeastern part of the United States was hurricanes, which just proves that you can't plan for things like that or just assume that, oh, well, I don't live anywhere where there are fires, floods, mudslides, etc. It's better than not to be prepared with insurance and, as you've described, the kinds of physical barriers to Mother Nature's onslaught. Can you give us other examples from your experience where people should have had their things put away but didn't?
I can think of a collection of African art where the collector accumulated well over 1,000 objects.
Wow.
Yet proper arrangements to have the works stored in a reasonably temperature controlled environment. When I say reasonably, they don't necessarily have to all be in a temperature controlled environment. Ideally, yes, but that can be sometimes expensive. But to have it stored where the temperature was constant, he stored it in sheds out on his property.
Oh, dear.
And unfortunately had to deal with the variations of the weather, not to mention the effect of mold and moisture and all types of problems with rodents and so forth. And many of the wooden objects have been irreparably damaged.
Yeah, you kind of read my mind, because when you were describing outdoor sheds, I was thinking about bugs and mice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think that's, as always, great advice for people who want to maintain their collections and their collectibles. And Larry, is there anything about this that we've not discussed that you think people would benefit hearing about?
There's one more area that's worth noting in my view, and that is for collectors to not store their fine art in basements or attics. And that's due largely to the proximity of the building exterior, whether it's the basement, to all sorts of vermin, the variations of temperature and moisture. That would be for the basement. And attics are particularly susceptible to dramatic temperature and relative humidity changes. And in addition to rodents, insects as well. So between all of those things, one would have thought, well, I'm going to put my objects in the basements where it's safe and maybe elevate them. I would think twice. Mm-hmm. And likewise, if they're looking to store objects in their attics.
Yeah, and likely those are the two places in most homes where people have space to store things. But what I'm hearing you say is that it's a bad idea because of, in the attics, and particularly in the south, it just gets unbelievably hot in the attic and in the basements because of things we spoke about earlier, water and insects, etc.
Precisely, and if they could segregate space within their homes that's dry, that would be ideal.
All right. Well, Larry, for the people who might want to chat with you individually, how can they get in touch with you?
They can reach me at lczale@aol.com, or if they'd like, visit my website at visualartsadvisory.com.
Outstanding. And Lawrence C. Zale, thank you for your contributions to the Collector Show as always.
Harold, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
One quick word before we wrap up another week of the Collector Show right after this.